And now, back to Brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is the budget deficit ceiling negotiations. Each of my guests is giving us a unique perspective on the negotiations that are happening in Washington, D.C., and its possible impact on the future. My next guest is an economist and a futurist, combining the most pessimistic and optimistic professions known. He'll cut through the rhetoric, the vitriol, and explain how the debt ceiling negotiations have already impacted the United States and how it may impact it in the future. And if you want to call in and ask a question or join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Jeff Threadgold is the president of Threadgold Economic Associates, a professional speaking and economic consulting company. Jeff served 23 years as a senior vice president and chief economist with KeyCorp, one of the nation's largest financial services companies. He served also for the past 13 years as an economic consultant to Zions Bank Corp. Jeff is an economic columnist for Business Issues, which is one of Asia's newest business publications. He's appeared on CNBC and on CNN. He's quoted frequently in the nation's business press, which includes the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Investors Business Daily, and Business Week. Joining us from a conference in Anaheim. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing today?
Doing well. How about you?
Well, doing terrific. And thank you for taking time away from your conference to be with us today and talk about this issue. Before we dive into it, though, I do want to zero in on your two sort of chosen professions there, being a futurist and an economist. How do you combine being a futurist and an economist? It's kind of an unusual combination, isn't it?
Yeah, we use the phrase economic futurist. I am a working economist. I've been one for almost 40 years. But at the same time, it's kind of fun to take a longer-term view, longer-term perspective on issues. And, you know, as a professional speaker, you're always fighting the idea, oh, we had an economist at our conference. They're terrible. They're boring. So part of it is by design. Economic futurist sounds a little different than economist, and that kind of supports one reason that we do it.
Yeah, well, it does have more sizzle. There's no doubt about it. All right, Jeff, let's dive into today's subject, can we? First of all, I want to set the stage for the listeners who may not have read this morning's newspaper. After months of discord, the Republicans and the Democratic lawmakers, they're expected to vote today on a White House-backed bill to raise the U.S. borrowing limit and avert an unprecedented debt default. That's good news. The Democratic-led Senate is expected to pass the deal, which raises the debt limit of $14.3 trillion and cuts about $2.4 trillion from the deficit over the next 10 years. But it may face tough opposition in the House of Representatives, where both conservative Tea Party supporters and liberal lawmakers have expressed dissatisfaction with the agreement. Now, I think it's cute that Winston Churchill once said, "Americans always do the right thing, usually after exhausting all other possibilities." So we've averted this financial Armageddon if this bill passes, or have we simply just pushed off making the hard decisions into the future, Jeff?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, there are some good parts to this proposed agreement. Well, there's no guarantee it's going to pass the House. There are some parts that simply kick the can further down the road. I'd written a piece last week. I've been writing a weekly newsletter for 36 years. And I wrote a piece last week called Political Cover. It was just the idea that, you know, realistically, the chance of default by the U.S., U.S. Treasury, you know, extraordinarily low. You know, one thing that I've been talking about that I think is important is, you know, these people, the president, the Treasury Secretary, the Senate and House leadership, these people surprisingly have enormous egos. And one thing they don't want to do is end up in the history book as those that were mining the store, those that were in charge when this great country defaulted on its debt. So they're going to take every avenue to avoid that. So we've made the case, you know, there isn't going to be a default. In fact, the August 2nd date of tomorrow really has some flexibility in it. They could, with the revenues that are coming in, I mean, they could keep payments on the debt, on Social Security, on Medicare payments to hospitals, military pay, you know, going for a number of weeks. Just by prioritizing, you know, where they spend the money. But having said that, there is also the issue that I do think there's a pretty good chance that the debt will be downgraded by Standard & Poor's or Moody's or Fitch or any combination of those three major rating agencies sometime later this year, unless they see a more substantial plan to re-
Well, that you bring up an interesting point. My guest is Jeff Threadgold, and you bring up about the credit rating agency. Standard & Poor's back in March hinted that there may be a credit downgrade for the United States, which brings up an interesting point. I mean, first of all, you have to look at the credit rating agencies, which are Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch that you described. Where were they when we were having this financial meltdown? What about their credibility market when they looked at, you know, these credit default swaps and said, oh, yeah, this is all AAA rated? And then we went into the toilet following that. So talk to me about that. You know, a downgrade coming from one of these agencies, does it really have the impact that it might if their agencies were less tarnished by prior prognostication?
Yeah, there's no question that, you know, these three major rating agencies really missed the boat a few years ago with putting AAA ratings on exotic types of debt instruments, putting AAA ratings on subprime mortgages that were sliced and diced and sold around the world and were really, you know, garbage once they went out the door. So their credibility is under a lot of pressure, no question. And maybe it's a little bit surprising that they, you know, the clout that they seem to be carrying now in terms of the debt and a potential downgrade and what impact that may have. Maybe it's a little bit surprising that they have as much of a following in terms of what they may do as is the case.
Well, let me just, I want to ask one more follow-on question, Jeff, if I can, to this, because the tomorrow's deadline that we have been looking towards for the debt ceiling increase was actually postponed. The deadline should have been in March, but through some financial manipulation, Timothy Geithner was able to extend it to August the 2nd, which is the deadline that we're now faced with. So if the real true deadline was March of 2011, where were Fitch, where was Standard & Poor's and Moody at that time saying, okay, now we're going to downgrade you because you've really missed the deadline. You've pushed it off into August, that's true, through some manipulation, but the true deadline was in March. If there was going to be a downgrading, why wasn't it in March?
Well, they, you know, S&P, for example, did indicate that there was a 50% chance that unless and until the U.S. got its financial house in order, that there was a 50% chance that the U.S. could be downgraded sometime in the next 18 months. You know, we've kind of pushed it forward to August 2nd. Again, realistically, with the government's had a pretty good surge in revenue the last two or three weeks. So the feeling is, you know, they've got plenty of money. They've got almost $200 billion coming in August. And they have the ability to make interest payments, to roll over some debt, to make Social Security payments. You know, you hear on the radio all the time, oh, the president says we can't pay Social Security. You got to buy gold and all this nonsense. You know, we're going to pay Social Security. We're going to pay the military. We're going to do these things, and we're going to pay the interest on the debt. We are not going to have a default on the debt. You know, we are still the richest nation in the world. We've just imposed, right or wrong, from the Republican side, you know, this this line in the sand. The Republicans won't go along with just the, you know, the 101st increase in the debt ceiling since 1940, unless they get something in terms of slowing down spending growth in coming years.
We're the richest nation in the history of the world, Jeff. I might remind you of that. Mm-hmm. Jeff Threadgold is the author of the book, Econ-America, Why the American Economy is Alive and Well, and What That Means for Your Wallet. We're discussing the debt ceiling limit increase that we're having right now in Congress. Jeff, talk to me about our relationships with the rest of the world. How are they viewing us as we go through this? And in particular, let's start with our largest creditor nation, which is China. How about U.S.-Chinese relations? How are they viewing us through all of this?
You know, U.S.-China relations right now are a little bit, I wouldn't say flawed, but a little heightened because they are very concerned about all these political games we're playing in terms of extending the debt. You know, the Chinese own about $1.15 trillion of U.S. Treasury bills, notes, and bonds, and so they have a vested interest in seeing that these investment instruments continue to perform well. You know, even if we get a downgrade in a few months, in my mind, it doesn't really mean a whole lot. You know, the financial markets will, you know, have always and will decide the value of one nation's debt versus another. You know, Japan's debt was downgraded from AAA to AA in the last year, and their interest rates are still the lowest in the world. But it's because Japanese investors buy massive amounts of their own debt. you know, so that there's nothing that's going to step up and replace U.S. Treasury bills, notes, and bonds as the safest, most liquid, most secure, most saleable securities in the world anytime soon.
Well, Jeff, that's an interesting point. And in your answer, you gave some very interesting statistics I want to come back and talk to. U.S.-China relations, China owns about $1.5 trillion, which is roughly, as I remember looking at, about 23% of all of our debt, our paper that's out there. Japan, on the other hand, has very few foreign creditors to their name. Most of the debt is owned by the Japanese people, which is different than it is here in the United States, which makes those two very different situations. Talk to me about the Japanese situation, their economy, why it's different, and more importantly, how is Japan viewing the United States as we're going through these machinations?
Well, Japan has always been unique. You know, they don't have any significant in-migration of people from other parts of the world, which is quite unusual. We've talked a lot in the last 18 months about Greece, you know, the fact that the Greek national debt relative to the size of their economy is 120-130%. The U.S. right now is about 95-100% of the size of our economy. The Japanese national debt is over 200% the size of their economy. Japan, relative to the size of its economy, is the biggest debtor in the history of the world. But they have this massive supply of investment. You know, all of the Japanese salarymen, the Japanese people, Japanese investors, they like to buy Japanese securities, even though the interest rates are extraordinarily low. You know, they're not running around the world chasing yield. They're buying, they're supporting their own country, and that's why even as they have this massive amount of debt, the average interest rate on this debt is about 1%.
My guest is Jeff Threadgold, author of the book Econ-America. And Jeff, I want to ask you a question about an issue that's floating around the House of Representatives right now, and that is a balanced budget amendment. In what ways would a balanced budget amendment ease some of the tensions that we're having right now over the debt ceiling if we were to enact one going into the future?
Well, it's one of those somewhat theoretical ideas that, you know, looks good on paper. You know, is it going to happen? I don't believe it ever will. I mean, in some ways you can make a case that we should do that. We don't seem to have the discipline in Washington to handle spending. But if you're talking about a balanced budget, you've got to obviously have both the House and the Senate approve it. It has to be approved by three-fourths of the states, and the political pressures to support or not support would be the equal of anything we've seen now, but at many of the states.
Well, so, California, for instance, has a balanced budget amendment, and yet we take 18 months to come up with an annual budget.
Yeah.
So there are some challenges.
Yeah, every state except one has to have a balanced budget. But as you know well, in California, there are ways to get around the rules. A balanced budget amendment doesn't allow a country to, you know, to step up in times of war or to step up in times of recession and move away from those boundaries or those limitations without a supermajority vote. So it can get a bit cumbersome. You know, I think the most important thing that I could add as we move towards closure here is when we talk, I mean, the American people are so scared, they're so confused about what's going on right now. You know, I make the case when I travel and speak and write, you know, we're not cutting, everybody talks about cutting spending. We're going to cut spending on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. We're not cutting spending on any of these things. What we're talking about is slowing down future growth rates of spending. Anytime you hear a reference, well, we've got to cut $600 billion out of Social Security, people think that's just money just chopped out right now. Well, anytime you see a reference to spending cuts, it is tied to long-term baseline projections of spending. We're talking about spending, you know, bending down the growth curve from 9% a year to 8% a year. But it's still spending more money each year. And, you know, I make the case if they would stop using this terminology, spending cuts, and say, hey, we need to slow down the growth rate of future spending. We'll have cost of living increase. We'll allow new people into these programs. We just got to make some tough decisions about slowing down this future growth in order to keep these programs viable. The American people would say, you know, I can understand that. That doesn't scare me. But they keep focusing on spending cuts, and I'm convinced they make their job in Washington much harder than it needs to be. I mean, only there can you spend more money year after year on a program and call it a spending cut.
My guest is Jeff Threadgold, author of the book Econ-America, Why the American Economy is Alive and Well and What This Means to Your Wallet. Jeff, if people like your common sense approach to this, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Easiest place is just our regular website, which is threadgold.com. It's just like it sounds, threadgold.com. Again, I've been writing weekly newsletters called The Tea Leaf for 36 years. We do monthly small business indexes for a variety of banks in the West. We do quarterly pieces, and the rest of the time I'm kind of jumping from one airplane to another to speak in a whole lot of different industries.
That is great.
We welcome people to our site and look at our newsletter.
That is great. Jeff, thank you so much for being my... Thanks so much, Jeff, for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you.